Has anyone noticed any problems with the economy lately? Anything that kind of comes to mind? What do you think the problem is? What's the fundamental issues behind some of the economic problems? Greed, all right. Fear and greed. That's what they call the economic cycle. The emotions that drive our economic cycle are referred to as fear and greed. And I noticed in an article that Warren Buffett had used those terms. Warren Buffett himself doesn't appear to be a particularly greedy man. He lives in an old house, drives a used car, well, an older car, and he hasn't, taken on the trappings of the wealth that he has acquired. But it is interesting, in his 2004 letter to the shareholders, he said he advised the investors, if you're going to live in this society and you're going to invest in this society, and this society is based on what? Fear and greed in terms of the economic cycle. He advised investors to be fearful when others are greedy and greedy only when others are fearful. So even though he doesn't necessarily emulate fear and greed in the same sense, but he just said, if you're going to invest in this economy, then you need to run against the course. But he used the terms fear and greed to describe the emotions or the choices that would be made by his investors as well. I guess I could give at least one illustration of how that greed seems to somehow take place and affects each of us. We got our property tax statement this year, and it's for 2009. And it says right on there what my house is worth. So I said, that's interesting. I'll go look at the one for 2008. And it says right there what my house was worth for last year and what the property tax assessment would be. And I took the amounts and subtracted one from the other, and it was something you could have easily done in your head because the assessment dropped a very small amount. They said that my house in 2009 was only worth 2.5% less than last year. Now, my house lost 2% last week. So I just thought, this is amazing. When it comes time to collect the needs of the state, then the collections have to be great. When it comes time to recognize the fact that my house is worth a portion of what it used to be, along with everyone else's, the adjustment was literally 2.5%. And I wanted to call them up. In fact, I checked on what the time of the office would be and when someone would physically be in. And one of these days, I'm going to call them up and I'm going to ask them, "Are you serious? What figures did you use for that?" But again, fear and greed. It just depends on who's got their hand out and what pot has to be filled. The Bible clearly warns us against that. Fear is in direct opposition to what? Now, again, this is a statement that I've made. It's what I believe. But fear is in direct, what does fear attack, minimize? What does fear corrode in our belief? Faith. It destroys our faith. Fear clearly does. I gave a sermon on that, and again, addressing why I thought that was so. God says, perfect love casts out fear. Love is the umbrella, right? God is love, therefore it covers all of the commandments. It covers not lying, not stealing, not coveting, and on a very broad basis. So God, in our lives, casts out fear. The problem is, fear and greed tend to run hand in hand. One is the ladder going up, and one is the slide coming down. Again, it's our economic system. If fear attacks our faith, what does greed attack in our character, on our values, and those things that we strive to emulate? What does greed attack? What's the antidote to greed? What character trait would you place on the opposite side? You can say God is love. As I would say, Satan is self. Satan's not hate, the opposite of love. The opposite of love, outgoing concern, is inward focus, self. I would say that with fear and faith. Faith is going this way, fear is going back. All right? If greed is going this way, which way is the other side? Well, giving, generosity, that's the first thing I came up with. And I thought, no, that is a response to something more fundamental than that. And I would have to say the actual antidote in that sense is humility. It is meekness and humility. Let me show you that, I believe, scripturally. It's important to understand because of what it is that we will be striving for in order to counter the impact of society around us. In the book of James, chapter 3 and verse 13, again, notice the way the instruction is given. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. In other words, God's words, his wisdom, his instructions, it's described as meekness of wisdom. Now, it gives the contrast to the meekness of wisdom because it's talking about two different kinds of wisdom, godly wisdom and the wisdom of this world, of this economic system, of Satan's ways. If you have, this is the contrast, bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts. Well, what word would I use if I was to take bitter envy, not just envious, but bitter envy that's very strong, and self-seeking, wanting, desiring for the satisfaction of the self? I would say, well, greed would fulfill that bill pretty well. If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, don't boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom, the greed, the selfishness, does not descend from above. It is earthly, sensual, satisfying the senses, desires to satisfy the self. Demonic, it is Satan's way. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing will be there. It's not surprising that the ultimate result of greed is every evil thing and confusion in the process. But the wisdom that is from above, now it describes what? It describes meekness of wisdom. So this is elements of meekness. It is first pure, then it's peaceable, it's gentle, it's willing to yield. You see, these are not competitive terms in that way, are they? There are terms in which a person is more willing to share and to contribute or to serve or to help or assist. Peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. He says, the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So I want to have us look at fear and greed in that context. The opposite, obviously, of fear is faith. By strengthening our faith, we weaken that tendency to be fearful. And by reaching out and striving to attain the meekness and humility and to apply it in this sense so that we are full of peace, we're gentle, we're willing to yield, full of mercy, and then the fruit of the meekness of wisdom becomes more evident in our lives. But it also takes that greed out of our lives and out of our focus. In the index, which I allowed Mike to handle for just a moment or two, I looked up greed to see, well, what had been included right here with greed. And right next to greed in the same subject was materialism, which goes hand in hand with greed. It is. It is the one of the gods of our society. I believe, I have stated, the gods of our society, because I used to compare that to the gods of Africa, the gods of Nigeria, human tradition, lordship, dominion in Nigeria. Well, the gods of our society is independence and freedom. Freedom to extreme, sex, and materialism. We worship materialism. You go to Africa, where they have superstition built in, it's so obvious, we walk in the door, we see superstition everywhere. In some respects, they are so used to it that it's almost the natural part of their existence. They come to the United States, they see materialism everywhere, and we walk around and don't even notice. Oh, we think we do in the most pretentious ways. But the fact is, the materialism seeps into our pores in the United States the way superstition seeps into the pores of those in Africa. It is a god sometimes we worship without even recognizing who we bow down to as a result. Have you ever heard of tulip mania? Somebody here has heard of tulip mania. I know Drew has. He just is being shy. Tulip mania goes back to Holland in the early 1600s, and it shows you that there is nothing new under the sun. The system that we have in this nation, as profitable as it has been in terms of God's work and His church being able to exist in the midst, is no different in any fundamental sense than the way the system of this world has existed over thousands of years, because it is Satan's world, and the greed and the fear that drive the system are his values. There's about 5,000 varieties of tulips in the world today. If you go back to about the mid-1700s, there was probably half that. If you go back to 1630, there was probably about 1,000. Half of those at that time were in Holland. The tulip didn't originate in Holland. It was actually imported, but it actually, you could see it took root there. It established itself. It became established in Holland because the people, if you could say it in this sense, they bowed down to the tulip. It was their materialism of their day. If you go back just 30 years before that, to the year, say, 1600, then you would have in the world no more than a couple of hundred varieties of the tulip. My point being this, we think of the tulip as simply being a commercial flower. You could buy it off the shelf, plant it anytime you please. But if you go back in time to where that was first being established in terms of where its native existence was, and then moved to places to where it could be bred and developed, you get to the point to where there was a time when the tulip was exceptionally rare, it was highly prized and extremely expensive, and ground zero for that process was the Netherlands. In the 1600s, of the beginning of that century, there was maybe 100 varieties that existed in that area of the world. Now, they wrote a whole book on tulip mania. I don't have time to read the whole thing to you, but I do want to read parts of it, because as I go, you're going to see unfold before you, full layout before you, exactly where we are today. It talks about the scarcity, the rarity, the cost of some of the tulips and the way they were traded. They were first traded amongst simply the richest people, and they were planted in their own gardens for their private pleasure, and they were highly sought after where they got a special variety that was different, that it had a virus or something, and that changed the coloring and the mix of the bulb, or at least the flower that came from it. But there was an effort then to start to produce this because they were so rare, because there was commercial benefit in developing something that was rare and then begin to sell it in the community. So it says by 1633, the combined efforts of the growers, the connoisseurs with the collectors, had solved the old problem of scarcity, at least to a degree. Tulips were at last widely available throughout the Netherlands. A total of some 500 varieties were then being grown in the Dutch Republic alone. Some were superbly fine and extremely rare, but others, still beautiful though, were easier to obtain. As the supply of the bulbs steadily increased, the flowers began to attract new admirers among tradesmen and the working men of the Dutch Republic. Men who had not until then been able to afford tulips and or displayed much interest in the bulb trade. Part of this work was that of the growers. Their most important customers, the connoisseurs, were demanding ever finer and rarer tulips, and it left the bulb farmers with the task of disposing of increasing quantities of the older, less spectacular varieties that naturally made up the bulk of their stock. They solved the problem by selling the flowers at low prices to new clients who had heard much exciting talk about the beauty of the flowers, and they wanted tulips of their own. This is a real story. I'm not making this up. I know it's going to sound almost silly. It is silly. And so is our society and the values and the things that are purchased and bought and sold in some ways. Some of the more ambitious growers even took to offering unwanted bulbs to members of the army of peddlers who traveled from town to town selling their wares at the local fairs and markets. The men hawked the flowers far and wide. They helped to introduce the cheaper varieties to farmers or laborers or people with very little means out in the countryside, and they spread the gospel of the tulip far and wide. In greater measure, though, the interest that many Dutchmen now developed in the flower trade owed less to the tulip's natural beauty than to the dawning realization that money could be made in bulbs. The value of some bulbs could double in little more than a week. The tulip mania climaxed in just two mad months, December 1636 and January 1637. In those few weeks, people and money poured into the tulip trade as Dutchmen across the United Provinces rushed to invest whatever they possessed in bulbs. Naturally, this sharp increase in demand pushed prices higher still, and for a while at least, everyone made money. Naturally, the prices quoted for a single bulb of the most celebrated of all tulips, the Semper Augustus, rose sharply too. From 5,500 guilders a bulb in 1633, a carpenter's yearly wage was 250 guilders. A year's work for a carpenter was 250 guilders. The most sought after, the rarest tulip single bulb rose from 5,500 guilders in 1633 to astonishing 10,000 guilders in the first month of 1637. The last sum mentioned could have been afforded only by a few dozen people in the whole of the Dutch Republic. We are talking about the Dutch trading companies and some of the richest merchants in the world. The bulb price of the most rare tulip was so high that only a few of them even could have purchased it as well. It was enough to feed, clothe, and house a whole Dutch family for half of a lifetime, sufficient to purchase one of the grandest homes on the most fashionable canal in Amsterdam for cash, complete with a coach house, an 80-foot garden, and this at a time when homes in the city were as expensive as any property in the world, a tulip bulb. From the autumn of 1635, then, the bulb trade changed fundamentally and forever. Ignoring the customs of the connoisseurs, increasing numbers of florists progressed from trading only tulips that they had in their possession to buying and selling flowers that were still in the ground. What do you call that? Futures. They started selling futures on tulip bulbs. The bulbs then ceased to be the unit of exchange. Now the only thing that changed hands was a promissory note, a scrap of paper giving details of the flower being sold and noting the date on which the bulb would be lifted when they would take it out of the ground and harvest the bulb and available for collection. Is that amazing? How different is that from our system of our society today? There were advantages to the new system. It certainly permitted trading to take place throughout the months of autumn, winter, and spring. Instead of just harvesting and selling your crop, you could now bet on the crop, sell the crop, buy it to somebody who never even was going to take delivery of the crop all through the year. Because the bulbs stayed where they were until lifting, no matter who their new owner was, it was very appealing to florists who had neither the skill nor the desire to cultivate bulbs themselves. But it was potentially very dangerous, too. Buyers had no opportunity to inspect the bulbs to see what they were buying or to even see them in flower. There was no guarantee of quality. A florist could not be sure that the bulbs he was purchasing really belonged to the seller or even if they actually existed. The Dutch called this phase of the tulip craze trading in the wind. It was a phrase rich in meaning to a seaman. It meant the difficulties of navigating a ship steering close to the breeze. To a stockbroker, it was a reminder that both the tulip trader's stock and their profits were so much paper in the wind. To the florists, however, what would we say? To the bankers, of the day. However, the wind handle, the trading in the wind, meant trading pure and simple, unregulated, unconfined. It was this innovation that made the greatest excesses of the mania possible. The introduction of promissory notes did much more than make the tulip trade a business that could flourish all year round. It turned dealing into an exercise in speculation. And because delivery was usually months away, it encouraged the sale and resale, not so much of bulbs, but of the notes themselves. Flowers that had once been valued for their beauty now became nothing but abstractions to dealers who cared only for their profits, and the repeated transfer of a dubious claim to ownership from one dealer to another became the chief characteristic of the bulb trade. Before long, to the scandal of straight-laced contemporaries, it became perfectly normal for florists to sell tulips they could not deliver to buyers who did not have the cash to pay for them and who had no desire to ever plant them. The best way of, let me go down just a little bit. In order to give bulb traders the basic information they needed to guess how a bulb might develop after planting, because now you're not buying what's already grown, now you have futures. So you have to now assess the value of the future of that contract. So they began to weigh each bulb as it would be measured for assessment to determine the viability of how that would produce in the future. Weights were given in aces, which was an extremely small measurement borrowed from the goldsmiths. One ace was equal to rather less than 2/1000ths of an ounce. So they began to weigh the bulbs in 2/1000ths of an ounce measurements, an ace, 1/20th of a gram. And mature tulip bulbs could weigh anything from 50 aces to more than 1,000, depending on the variety, as well as indicating the date on which a flower would be ready for lifting. Then, the promissory notes that were exchanged by florists also noted the bulb's weight when it was passed, when planted, and the ledgers each dealer used to record his purchases always included a column the dealer listed for the size of his bulbs in aces. From this, it was a very short step to selling tulips not by the bulb, but the ace itself. They invented shares. They now had shares in tulip bulbs in which to bid and buy on the futures and to exchange in their business year-round. A number of people could go together and buy a single bulb and take shares in between them. The number of people involved in dealing bulbs was so swiftly increasing. As florists from the artisan class flocked to join connoisseurs and merchants who had long been involved in the tourist trade, in the tulip trade, some ambitious artisans began to buy and sell flowers in 1634, 1635, right before the very peak of the mania. But it was not until the autumn of the following year that the very poorest florists entered the market in large numbers, with the greatest influx of newcomers coming in December of 1636 and January of 1637, right in time to be destroyed. In the autumn of 1636, many Dutchmen must have thought that the profits being made on tulips were simply too good to be true. But thousands did not. They took their savings, mortgaged their goods in order to take part in the hurly-burly of the bulb trade. Now, it gives an example here of a bulb if it was sold for 3,000 guilders. That's not the most expensive bulb, but it is a very expensive bulb. But there were bulbs trading hands at that level of the finest variety. 3,000 guilders would exchange for 8 pigs, 4 oxen, 12 sheep, 24 tons of wheat, 48 tons of rye, 2 hogsheads of wine, 4 barrels of beer, this is all of it, not just each of it, 2 tons of butter, 1,000 pounds of cheese, a silver drinking cup, a pack of clothes, a bed with mattress and bedding, and a ship to carry it all in. 3,000 guilders went for some of the more specific bulbs. It is a ransom, a king's ransom, as this progressed. chapter 13 says bust. The great crash in tulip prices began in Harlem on the first Tuesday of that February, when a group of florists gathered to buy and sell, as usual, one of the city's tavern colleges. They called the college the group that would get together to buy and sell the bulbs. As was customary, an established member of the college began the day's trading by testing the state of the market. He offered a pound. The cheaper bulbs would be sold by the pound. And so he's offered a pound of Kronen or Switzers for sale. He asked a fair price, 1,250 guilders for the bulbs. And in the normal course of events, he would have found several eager buyers. Slates and chalk would have been distributed, the tulips would have been knocked down to the highest bidder, and the rest of the day's trading would have continued in its usual frenzied way. On this day, however, there were no bidders for the bulbs at 1,250 guilders. The auctioneer offered them again, cutting the price to 1,100 guilders. Still, there was no interest. Desperately now, he offered his bulbs for a third time, dropping his price to 1,000 guilders per pound, and again, there were no bids. In all likelihood, every one of the traders present had paid similar prices for similar bulbs within the past few days in anticipation of selling again for a handsome profit. Now, in a matter of no more than a minute or so, their assumptions had been shattered. The ugly question of what would become of the bulb trade had been raised. Plainly, it would have been impossible to continue with the normal business of the day. Perhaps some brief attempt was made to sell some other bulbs without success, but the college must have suspended trading almost immediately. And in the general confusion, one or two of the assembled company, no doubt, ran to inform their friends and family of what had occurred. In no time at all, the colleges in Harlem would have heard the news, and every florist in town beyond the walls would have been gripped by a simple impulse: sell. Greed has turned to fear. It took only a few days for the panic to spread through the rest of the United Provinces. In college after college, in town after town, desperate florists discovered that flowers that had been worth thousands of guilders only a day or two before now could not be sold at any price. A few dealers kept their heads and tried to stimulate interest by organizing mock auctions and offering bulbs at huge discounts, but they were ignored. In most places, the tavern trade crashed so completely that it was not even a question of prices falling to a quarter or a tenth of what they had been when the mania was at its peak. The market for tulips simply ceased to exist. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Man's ways are greed and fear in the market, in the economy, and is the basic impulse that has driven man over time. George Hegel, German philosopher, I gave a sermon once and I referenced the Hegelian dialectic, where there's a thesis and then there's the antithesis, and the way to find truth is to combine the two and get the synthesis. Obviously, that's not the way to find truth. The way to find truth is to accept God's word as he states it, but it was George Hegel that came up with that. He was a philosopher. He came up with one other thing that actually has significant merit. He said, what history and experience teach is this, that the people and governments have never learned anything from history or acted on principles deduced from it. Where was the lesson from the Netherlands, from Holland, in our economic system today? It was simply not learned because it's driven by fear and greed. Stock market in the United States, Dow Jones Industrial Average, is only one measure of a part of the market. It peaked on April the 7th of last year. It peaked at 14,164 on that measure. Okay? Checked it yesterday. Dow Jones Industrial Average was at 66.27 yesterday. That's not, we haven't gone a year from April until today. That's a 53% drop in 11 months. There used to be a saying, as goes GM, so goes the country, because the business was so fundamental to our culture and our industry and our employment that it was considered to be a barometer of the health of our society economically. As goes GM, so goes the country. General Motors stock peaked last year on February the 2nd, so we're a little over 12 months on that one. It was $28.98. Checked it yesterday. It closed yesterday at $1.45. That is a 95% drop. There are people who had General Motors stock in their portfolios. There are pension plans. There are people planning to retire and live off of that that have lost 95% of their value. It's like the tulips. One day, they just really weren't worth anything anymore. Everything changed. Greed turned to fear, and the market switched. We live in a bubble economy, and we live in a bubble economy because of the way man has chosen to print and produce and invent money and resources based on fear and greed. There was the dot-com bubble. That's what they refer to it as. There was the credit bubble, and the credit bubble helped produce the housing bubble. And people bought homes they couldn't afford because it didn't matter, because it would be worth more next year anyway, and even if they had to sell it, they would at least gain the difference. There was more money to be made in home ownership than there was by going to work for most people in terms of what could be then pulled out or saved. All these bubbles were created that were not fundamentally different from the bubble in Holland with tulips. You ever noticed there was no gold bubble? Because you have to dig it out. You have to refine it. It has to be produced. You can't make it out of something else. You can't write it on a piece of paper and say this is it, because it's not. There was no gold bubble. Some people say, well, it is. It's inflated. Well, okay. Last year, from January 1 to this year, January 1, I think gold increased, I think, if I remember correctly, 3%. That's not exactly a bubble. While everything, GM stock, went down 95, at least it held and increased a little more. So yeah, there are parts of the market that take great shocks and change numbers and percentages in dramatic ways, and gold did that as well. I'm not telling you what you need to do. I'm telling you what is, though. You'll have to decide for yourself. Jim Cramer, I heard him on the radio this week. Now, Jim Cramer, I don't listen to him much, but I know his name, and I know he's a financial advisor. He's on the media, and he presents material on the markets and stuff. And he came on one of the shows as I was driving, and I heard him, and he said, I'm a Democrat. I'm a lifelong Democrat. He says, I voted for our president. I believe in these things. He mentioned some of the things that he believed in terms of the health of our environment and being willing to care for people in their need and things that were part of his value system. And he said, what we are seeing is the greatest destruction in personal wealth in history. And he was flaming red mad on the radio. The greatest destruction of personal wealth, he said, in history. He said, you know me. He said, I have never recommended gold. I have always been in the market. He says, what do I tell people now? Gold and cash? But he felt like the economy was simply in the process of being destroyed. I just have to tell you, I hope that's not a political statement. I hope it's a statement based on the reality of what has taken place, based on an individual that actually supported the system, wanted this system. And he said, I didn't get what I wanted. This wasn't what I voted for. One thing I like about having a small group, too, is that there's probably less to retract if I have to go back and clean up my shirt. Proverbs 15 and verse 27. I'll try very hard to be responsible in my comments, and not just go crazy like some have on the radio lately. Proverbs 15 and verse 27. He who is greedy for gain troubles his own house. Boy, how literal is that? He who is greedy for gain troubles his own house. But he who hates bribes will live. Bribes. Well, what's bribes got to do with it? You know, it talks about being greedy for gain. Okay, some element of being greedy could include bribes. Well, I think it's remarkably significant. What's an earmark? An earmark is a political bribe that is given to an individual so that he will vote on a particular bill. And so the stimulus package was put together, and the media now has been assessing it, and the count comes out something like 8,600 earmarks were included in the bill. Those are bribes. And that is indeed a biblical issue. And God says that he hates bribes to live, but he is greedy for gain, troubles his own house. Somebody is troubling our house to the point to where GM stock is down 95% in a year. I was reading another article. There was a great big fight by different politicians on Capitol Hill, a fight to the point of literally shouting and cursing and yelling to where people in the hallways were kind of feeling uncomfortable about the process that was taking place. And you know what it was about? The Republicans had been paid off, and they weren't playing ball on the bill. They had been given their earmarks. They had been given their bribes, and they were supposed to put their votes on the dotted line, and when they did not, you could say all of the underworld broke loose. And in a visible and dramatic way. We paid you, and you didn't play. Well, I guess that's troubling our house too, is it not? 1 Timothy 3 talks about the quality and characteristics of leadership in the church. We have to be different. We have to do this the way God called us to. 1 Timothy 3, verse number 1. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires a position of a bishop, an overseer, he desires a good work. It is good if God grants you gift and opportunity to serve in that way. A bishop, though, must be blameless. Husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach. But notice as well, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money. You can't be subjected or subjecting yourself to the values of this world system. But gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. Remember on the meekness and the humility, it says here they're hospitable, they're of good behavior, they're gentle, they're not quarrelsome, they're peacemakers. Down in verse number 8, where the deacons are mentioned, it says, likewise, deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy for money. It's important for leadership in any position, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let them first be proved. Show me effectively, not me, just me, but Paul is talking to Timothy, let them first be proved, then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. Make sure it's the real deal. Bernard Madoff, I think that's how it's pronounced, I'm not totally sure, his name has become a household name because he ran a $50 billion, I don't even know what a billion is. I don't know what a billion is. I can say it, but I can't conceive it. I can't picture more than the guilders that were available for that bulb that bought the house and the servants, more than that. $50 billion Ponzi scheme. You know who Mr. Ponzi is, right? It's his scheme. There's a guy that invented the Ponzi scheme. It's like the guy who invented the outdoor toilet, was named after him as well. They call it a toilet. Overseas. Ponzi schemes. In a Ponzi scheme, potential investors are wooed with promises of unusually large returns, usually attributed to the investment manager's savvy skill or some other secret sauce. You can imagine the economy of this nation is one big Ponzi scheme. That's the way it is. The returns are repaid, at least for a time, out of new investors' principal. In our government's case, our taxes. Not from profits. This can continue as long as new investors line up with cash and old investors don't try to withdraw too much of their money at once. Ponzi schemes are also known as pyramid schemes from the shape of any chart that reflects their basic premise, that ever-growing layers of new recruits are needed to provide gains to the smaller, earlier cohorts. A gigantic pyramid scheme virtually bankrupted Albania after the fall of communism. Ponzi schemes are named after Charles Ponzi. Wouldn't you know it? I mean, after a guy. A flamboyant con man whose scam followed a particularly spectacular course. Mr. Ponzi began telling New York investors in December of 1919 that investments in foreign postage coupons would yield 50% return in 45 days. Who wants to buy in? That's a lot of money quick, right? What does it take to buy into something like that? Fear? Greed. It takes greed. If it sounds like it's too good to be true, probably is. Probably is. By redeeming coupons bought cheaply overseas for much higher amounts in the United States, he could double their money in 3 months, he claimed. Mr. Ponzi was a fast-talking immigrant, college dropout. His scheme, according to his biographer in a book that was written, rested on the eagerness of ordinary working people to benefit from the wealth they saw generated around them as the economy recovered from World War I. As the fever spread, millions of dollars were coming in every week, 1919. Millions of dollars were coming in every week. What did P.T. Barnum say? Sucker born every minute. I think that's what he said. He didn't tell me personally. From ordinary working class people investing as little as $10 at a time. Where would you even get boxes big enough to hold all of that? It says it estimated that nearly 3/4 of the Boston Police Department invested in Ponzi notes. Can you imagine scamming the police? I mean, how much hope is there in that? It says as they became 3/4 of the Boston Police Department. It says, with successive waves of people entrusting him with their cash, Ponzi needed only enough money to pay off those people redeeming their coupons. Of course, with the prospect of increasing their savings exponentially every couple of months, nobody ever redeemed anything, so there was no redemption required. A born overreacher, Mr. Ponzi sketched out ever more grandiose financial schemes and, always smiling, talked as fast as he could. Bernard Madoff invested the money in a Ponzi scheme of his own friends, personal acquaintances that he had known for decades. He took their money and he put it into a scheme where he simply paid off those who invested in their interest when it was time. It wasn't enough. It goes on to say eventually, as officials and the banks began digging and as the press began looking into what he was doing, the gates of the prison swung open and he was locked up, and the brilliant reign of Charles Ponzi came to an end. Convicted of mail fraud, says he died penniless in Rio de Janeiro in 1949, buried in a pauper's cemetery there. All he'd have had to do was work with his hands a little bit. He wouldn't have had to die without a penny, you wouldn't think. Then it goes on and says, the $50 billion fraud that federal authorities say Bernard Madoff perpetrated has been called the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Though the magnitude, scale, and details are different, Mr. Ponzi's scheme and the fraud that Mr. Madoff has been charged with each reflect their respective superheated financial eras, which means greed ran rampant because you could not accomplish that task in any other way. Satan can only get us to do what we already want. He can't make us do something we don't believe in and we don't feel like and we object to. He can only get us to do something that we already want, fear and greed. James 4 illustrates that. Verse number 1, where do wars and fights come from among you? He's writing to the church. Do you not know they come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you don't receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. A description of the impact of greed. Adulterers and adulteresses, don't you know the friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world or its system or its values makes himself an enemy of God. Go back to Proverbs 15 as well. Additional illustration in this one place, but verse 16, Proverbs 15, verse 16. It says, better is a little with fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Better to have something that's right and works than to try to get a lot and have trouble that pay for it along the way. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. God warns us to be careful. I was driving down the hill into Lewiston today. Steep hill at the very bottom. It goes 55, 45, 35 as you slow down. And yet you're still on the open highway, and it looks quite easy in terms of being able to speed through. But it's narrowing down because part of the road is going to take off again to the left, and the other will go on into the city. There was a driver right behind me, right on my bumper, you know, going back and forth. And the cars are slowing down, getting ready to divide which way they're going to go. And again, this car kept pushing right up behind me and finally came up alongside and shot out past me on the left. And then as it got next to the car in front of me, all of a sudden, it just stopped right down. It was going the same speed that all the rest of us were. And so I looked around, and there was the police car, you know. Right there on the side of the road is this police car. They got around and started to race off down the highway, and then they saw the police. What's our stop sign? What is it that stops us from doing those things that are not prudent? What is it that will keep us from the fear and the greed and the response to the values of this society? Well, look at the example of Moses, Hebrews 11, in response to the very similar things. Hebrews 11 and verse number 23 talks about faith here in terms of Moses, his parents, but then him personally. Hebrews 11, verse 23, it says, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents. Because they saw he was a beautiful child, they were not afraid of the king's commandment. You see, we're supposed to fear God, but not man. And it was their faith here, and it was not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, not willing to compromise, wanting to do that which was most necessary and right according to what he was called, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. He looked to the reward of his calling. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. He chose to suffer affliction rather than to imbibe in the prosperity and the delicacies of the palace and of Egypt. Egypt portraying sin. Okay. What goes with that? What goes with his faith? Moses was what? Very humble. In fact, the King James says that he was meek. He was the meekest man on earth. The New King James uses the word humble. Humility and meekness was firmly in place so that his faith could be strong enough to make those choices. What is the antidote to greed? I believe it is meekness and humility. It is not lifting yourself up in that way. There is at least one more bubble to come. There might be more, but there's at least one. Revelation 18. This is a bubble, and it's a bubble down the road. It's not been here yet fully, maybe in type, but not specifically. Revelation 18, verse number 7. Notice what is in the context of Babylon, the merchant's empire, and the power that rises up in that way. Verse 7, Revelation 18. In the mixture that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously. So she glorified herself, lifted herself up, and lived luxuriously. In that same measure, give her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, I said as queen, I'm no widow, and will not see sorrow. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day. Isn't that amazing? The system is going to collapse almost in a moment in time. It's going to be like that bulb trade. And one day everybody's bidding the bulbs up and they're living rich and high and there's great hope and future. And the next day it is gone. It doesn't even exist. You can eat them if you care. But they have no value any longer. Look at the merchandise, verse number 9. The kings of the earth committed fornication, lived luxuriously with her. They'll weep and lament when they see the smoke of her burning. Babylon has to rise for it to fall. Now, the system, the economic system that we're in now, may well be falling in a sense that a power, a beast, can come in as a result. We will see. But it will rise here, God says, prophetically again. This is the final bubble. But it goes down, the merchants of the earth weep and mourn, gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, and it just goes on and on. Anything anyone would ever desire. Verse 15, the merchants of these things became rich by her. They stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas. Verse 17, for in one hour such great riches came to nothing because it wasn't based on what God has built. It was man's system of just inflation and confiscation and corruption, fear and greed. Let's go back to look at what we have to do, what we have to put on, the way we have to think in order to counter the impact of these things in our lives. Colossians 3 and verse number 12. Colossians 3, verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, those who have been selected by God, the elect, selected, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies. It's talking about humility, meekness. Put on meekness and humility in order to counter the environment which we're going to be living, and in order to be able to choose to do the right thing. Put on tender mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And then something happens as a result. Instead of chaos and turmoil, it brings peace. It gives us peace. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing in grace in your hearts to the Lord. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Fear and greed is one thing that we need not participate in. We can put on tender mercies, meekness and humility, and therefore fulfill our purpose as the elect of Jesus Christ.